There's an old metaphor. It goes all the way back to Plato. That metaphorically, the mind is like a womb, that ideas dwell in the mind as in the womb, and then they are born when we conceive them and utter them and bring them forth. Similarly, the mind of God is the womb of all creation. If we all exist before our earthly span of life as ideas in the mind of God and then come forth, God is eternally pregnant.
Barbara Newman is the John Evans Professor of Latin and Professor of English Classics and History at Northwestern University. She's the author of about a dozen books, including a new one we discussed today, titled The Permeable Self, Five Medieval Relationships. The book explores the phenomenon of co-inherence, the deep, inextricable influences on our personhood by other teachers, mothers, romantic partners, and even beings from the supernatural world. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. It's a special occasion today because we have our guest, Barbara Newman, not only to talk with her in the podcast, but actually here in person at BYU, because she's a lecturer giving the Special Faith and Imagination Lecture sponsored by the Humanities Center and also the co-sponsored by the Nan Grass Professorship here at BYU. Barbara Newman, welcome to campus. It's great to see you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
It is a pleasure. We actually planned this 2 years ago, right? And you agreed to come. We had the day. And then right before the flight, practically, out came the pandemic and then got closed down. So this has been a long awaited.
This was the first of the six speaking engagements that I had canceled by the pandemic, and almost 2 years to the day, I'm glad that it's finally happening.
That's right. Yeah. We don't usually plan out 2 years in advance. Thank you for your endurance. So I begin by asking guests how faith figures into their life and work, and I'm curious about what faith means to you, and religious faith in particular. You know, you've devoted so much of your life to understanding different kinds of religious faith that manifest themselves during the medieval period. Have your encounters with faith during the medieval period caused you to reflect differently on your own faith? Have they changed your ideas or your practices about faith?
I think they have. I've spent a very long career now reflecting with and about medieval theologians, mystics, holy women especially, and I've learned some ways of thinking. I've really internalized some ways of thinking that come to us from the deep past, but I think are still viable and productive ways of living faith in God today. So sometimes I feel I'm almost bi-traditional. I mean, I'm a contemporary Christian. My particular faith tradition happens to be the Episcopal Church, the Catholic wing of it. But I'm also this funny medieval person. and so I sometimes live in dialogue with myself as
great.
Well as with God.
Yeah, I love that. What drew you to medieval studies in the first place? Were your interests at all related to religion?
Oh, very much so. Yes, I attended Oberlin College, where I was a double major in English and religion. This is what I've always done. I've always done literary studies of religion, religious studies of literature, and I am a convert myself. I was baptized at the age of 19 as a college sophomore, and about the same time that I chose to be baptized, I also chose to become a medievalist. I mean, to study the period that I think saw some of the most sophisticated theological thinking and profound contemplative practice in Christian history. So the two things very much went together for me.
I think that's really interesting. You've written a lot about the way these things really kind of fold together in your professional life. And your new book, actually, let's talk about that. The Permeable Self, subtitled Five Medieval Relationships, is a fascinating study of how religious thinking permeates across an entire period in a way of thinking about what it means to be human. You write about this phenomenon you call co-inherence, which describes sort of being within one another, or having other beings inform who we are at a foundational level. How did you come to be interested in co-inherence, and why write a book about it?
Why write a book about it? Because I think it is a deeply valuable way of understanding what it means to be a person. There is a growing consensus that the conception of personhood that we really inherit from the Enlightenment focused very much on individualism, on personal autonomy, is not adequate. It cuts us off from one another, and it underestimates the very profound ways that we shape one another's being and life in the world. I picked up the term coherence from Charles Williams. For those of you who have not heard of Charles Williams, I think he's one of the most underrated British intellectuals of the 20th century. He died in 1945. He was an English poet, novelist, playwright, lay theologian, and a fascinating religious and metaphysical thinker. And he picked up the idea of coherence from the church fathers, but it is this idea that, as you say, our being is within one another, we bear one another's burdens, we permeate each other, and that is both a metaphysical fact about the nature of human existence in the image of God, because it's also a fact about divine existence, and it's an intentional spiritual practice, something that we can accept, nurture, and learn to live with. I encountered Williams many, many years ago, I think also in college, became fascinated first with his novels, and then with his poetry, and later with his theological work. And I've always had a kind of bee in my bonnet about what is this coherence? How can I understand it better? And this book, The Permeable Self, took me more than 10 years to write, because I'd think about it and write a chapter and then put it aside and do other projects and then come back to it and then put it aside and then come back to it. And so it is something I've been thinking about for a very long time.
The book reads that way. It reads like, it doesn't read like an idea you picked up off a shelf somewhere and sort of hurried to get to publication. It reads like something that really has been sitting with you for a long time, because there's so many layers of reflection to the book and to how you developed the idea. It's fascinating. And the way you talk about that just a moment ago, that really seems right. We do certainly inform each other at really profound levels. That seems right to how we are kind of formed in our personhood and our selfhood. But as you point out in the book, there are metaphysical and theological dimensions to this that go beyond our typical reflection about what it means to be a person in the world. In fact, you explain that it's an idea taken from the concept of the Trinity, the theology of the Trinity. And I'm wondering whether you can help us understand exactly how that is, how co-inherent personhood and Trinitarian personhood, you know, kind of inform each other or intersect.
Yeah, let me begin with the New Testament, because I think that one of the most philosophically important words in the New Testament is the preposition in, that little preposition. Mm-hmm. Think of Jesus' sayings, especially in his farewell discourse in the Gospel of John 14 and thereabouts, where he says, I am in the Father, and you in me, and I in you. What does that mean? Well, we can say, well, Christ is in the Father, okay, you know, some in some airy theological realm that we can't comprehend. But then he goes on, and he brings it down to earth. He says, I am in you, and you are in me. And coherence is a way of reflecting on what this in means. It's also in the epistles of Paul, where he says, I live, but now not I, but Christ in me. And this language, we find it again in Adam, all have sinned. in Adam. How are we all in Adam? Well, through coherence, right? Adam as the kind of concrete universal form of all humanity. And so when Adam fell, we all fell, not just because we imitated him, Adam sinned, and then later on we sinned, but rather the whole human race exists in the solidarity. And if there's solidarity in evil, there's also solidarity in redemption. We are all in Christ, who is the new Adam, right? The second Adam. And so theologians of the Trinity in the early centuries of Christianity, in the 4th, 5th, 6th century, worked out in some detail what this in means. I'd like to introduce one of the Greek terms that they used to describe this, because it's really a very beautiful word, perichoresis, which is related to the word chorea, which is a dance. And what it means is dancing around one another. Right? The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit dance around one another. It can also be translated yielding to one another, or simply being in one another. Christians teach, this goes back to the book of Genesis, that human beings are created in the image of God. The image of God isn't just one thing. It's not just God has free will, so we have free will. God is rational, so we are rational. There are infinite facets to that image of God, and one of them is this being permeable, this existing in coherence with each other.
That's really fascinating. I love that image of the dance, kind of this interweaving, you know, of bodies and selves and parts of ourselves with each other and with God. It strikes me, the Latter-day Saint, you know, in my church's theology, we don't believe in the Trinity as such. The Godhead, yes, so Father, Son, Holy Ghost, but not quite in that kind of Trinitarian relation to each other that you're describing. But the way you describe that these permeable selves really does reveal to me just how much how significant the idea of the Trinity is to how we imagine what it means to be a human being.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I don't think many modern Christians of any denomination think a great deal about the doctrine of the Trinity. But let me just say one more thing about that. Some years ago, I was leading a retreat on medieval women mystics. I'd been asked to take up this topic, and I decided to focus on their conceptions of the Trinity. So I did that.
That'd be fascinating, by the way.
Oh, it was quite fun. Yeah. And it was for, I think, mostly Methodists. I mean, it was not either your church or my church. But the pastor of the church where I was leading it asked in the questions at one session, well, why is the Trinity so important? I mean, aren't we just monotheists? You know, we believe in God, you know, isn't that enough? And I said, no, it isn't, because the Trinity is a community of love. And if we think of simply a, you know, one, like, I'm thinking now of, not of subtle theologians, but of, you know, common people asked, what is the most important attribute of God? They might say power. You know, God, I mean, this stereotypical idea of God is the old man in the sky. I mean, this has never been anyone's sophisticated idea of God, but it's out there. We think of God as the one who has all the power, the one. And what does power mean in human terms? Power means control over the lives of other people and the ability to kill them. And we can so easily extrapolate from that to a punitive God whose principal function is judgment and executing his wrath, right? But if we think of a Trinity, it's not just that the Father is in the Son and the Son in the Father, but what is that relationship? That relationship is love. And to think of the Trinity as three persons in an eternal community of love gives yet another meaning to being created in the divine image.
That's a beautiful thought, and that really resonates with me. You know, I mean, the idea of God as power, it's kind of foreign. I mean, yes, omnipotence, and okay, I accept that as a Christian, but But that's not the dominant feature I associate with God. It really is a, I mean, even the conception we have theologically is one of a family bound together, and it's relationships of love that define the nature of God's being, and certainly in relation to his creation. And I think that's a gentleness, kindness. These are features I associate far more with God than I do power and wrath, you know, and exhibitions of strength. Though he's certainly capable of such things. Let's run through some topics in your book, because how this all takes shape in the book, I think, is so fascinating. The first is a relationship between teacher and student.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what does co-inherence mean in that context?
Yes. I talk in the book about a kind of teaching that is certainly not the dominant model in our high schools or colleges or universities. And this is charismatic teaching, teaching where the prime mode of the student's learning is to imitate the teacher, to become like the teacher. I think we see this most in areas other than academic learning, violin lessons, karate, you know, yoga. If you're learning music or sports or any kind of physical skill, when you start out, you try to model yourself on the expert performance of your teacher. You know, if she is a skilled yogini and she can do all the asanas really beautifully, you want to be like her. And you also want to have the serenity and calm that she hopefully has.
Not just the sweat and pain.
Right. And if you're learning to play the piano and your teacher just performs Mozart or Chopin so magnificently, you want to play just like your teacher. Well, in earlier periods, in antiquity, in the Middle Ages, academic learning was conceived very much the same way. If you were studying philosophy, you wanted to learn not just philosophical doctrines or modes of argument. You wanted to learn how to live philosophically, how to let your philosophy permeate your whole life. And your teacher was the model who showed you how to do that. And so I look at specific teacher-student relationships as we can reconstruct them in the medieval period, from letters between teachers and their old boys, elegies for famous teachers who died, panegyrics, and you see what is almost a little disturbing because it looks like a cult of personality, but you see this intense relationship of love between the teacher and the student. I like a quotation from St. Augustine, who lived back in the 5th century and was one of the prime movers of this method of pedagogy, who said something I think all of us teachers should bear in mind, which is, when our students listen to us teaching, we speak in them what we say, and we hear what we are teaching through the way that they learn it, so that what we teach becomes forever new. So even if we've taught something time and time and time again, the students are always learning it for the first time, so it's new to them, and it becomes new to us as well. And the phrase he uses is, there is a mutual indwelling between the teacher and the student. That's co-inherence.
Right, that's great, and really fascinating. And the university teacher in me, I was particularly keen on that chapter and thinking about it. In fact, all these chapters have codas at the end where you talk about some kind of connection between what you've been talking about in its more ancient historical practice and its modern valence. And there's a really interesting one in this chapter. These really appealed to me. You talk about the university idea that one hears once in a while these days about educating the whole person, right? Whole person. Over the years, I have had shifting attitudes toward the idea of teaching the whole person. I like the idea more as I get older in the profession than I did when I was younger and edgier, you know? I'm curious where you come down on the whole, because there is some controversy there, right? Because of the whole cult of personality business, et cetera. Where do you come down on the whole person idea? How, in other words, I guess, how medieval do you imagine your own teaching practices to be?
Well, as a woman, I certainly could not have been a university teacher or even a student in the Middle Ages. So in one sense, not medieval
true.
At
okay.
all.
Good.
In another sense, I love the idea of teaching the whole person, but only if the student as a whole person wants to be taught that way.
Yeah.
Because it has to be mutual. It's not something you can force. You cannot impose your values on your students. You cannot proselytize your students. One way we see that problematically today is, at least in the humanities in academia, we tend to share a liberal or progressive political stance. And for students who do not share that stance, there's often tension, and they do not want to internalize the values of their teachers, and they shouldn't have to do that. I think we see much more of this teaching the whole person in the relationships we have with graduate students, because a graduate student will be with us for a period of 5, 6, 7 years, and much more like the medieval student who was much younger, the graduate student will often model herself on the teacher, on the teacher's methodology, on her approach to scholarship, not simply on what she happens to have written, but how she does her work. And you know, I continue to have lifelong friendships with many of my former graduate students, a few of my old undergraduates, but not so many. And you know, so that's medieval, I guess.
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting you talk about the political basis for a lot of how we sort of understand ourselves as academics. When I got to BYU from UCLA, I brought a lot of that sensibility with me into the classroom, and that's what caused some friction. You know, because I came here in the Bush versus Gore election year, and I was all up in arms about various and sundry. These days it's different. These days I tend to approach this more understanding kind of the common religious framework that students have at BYU, a common set of theological ideas, all children of God, made in the divine image. Sharing certain ideas about why education is important. You can't assume certain things at BYU that I could never assume when I was at UCLA. It gives a different dimension to whole person, and I find myself drawn to that these days a lot more than I am to student political points of view, which have grown, frankly, less important to me over the years. I'm just hearing this as you talk, out of two sets of ears, my grad student ears and the ears as a 20-year in BYU professor that looks at the world a bit differently. Let me move on to the next. If you want to say something, feel free, but I want to go on to the next chapter. You explore the relationship of saint and sinner, and you specifically turn our attention to the phenomenon of mind reading or a co-inherence of minds. What drew you to this topic, and what are you trying to get at here in this chapter?
Yes, I look at a particular corpus of saints' lives that happen to be from the long 13th century in the Diocese of Liège, which is part of modern Belgium. But you find this in other saints' lives earlier and later as well. And I was simply struck by studying this body of sources. I've translated many of them. I know them well. And just noticing how often this particular type of miracle would come up. Miracles of telepathy, where someone, let's call them a client, you know, a lay person, would go not to a priest, but to a holy woman or a lay brother, as a brother who was not a monk but attached to a monastery. They would go for what we might call counseling or spiritual direction. And the holy person would read their mind, would know what sins they had committed and not yet confessed. Or sometimes the person might have received a special grace, you know, a visit from the Virgin Mary or Christ appearing and saying something to them. And out of humility, they wouldn't say that this had happened, but the holy person would know by telepathy. And I was just struck by how often this theme would come up. And nobody wrote about it. And I asked myself, what's with that? Why is this happening? Why do people think it's so important? And then I found that some of the church fathers, Augustine talks about this, Gregory the Great talks about this, Dante, it's all over the Divine Comedy, especially the Paradiso, where the saints in paradise can read each other's minds, and they can read the mind of Dante, the pilgrim, as he passes through. And again, you know, what's with this? And I discovered that telepathy is seen not only as a powerful tool for spiritual direction, but a kind of indication of what minds redeemed from sin would be able to do. Because it's probably a mercy that in this life we can't read each other's minds, because we don't need to know all of the evil thoughts that other people graciously suppress and don't speak about. But if we were free of sin, if we had no evil thoughts, then wouldn't it be wonderful if we could all communicate in this way, in a kind of perfect coherence?
It's a lovely idea, that latter. If you could read my mind, you know, I'm curious about this next chapter here, where you talk about romantic love.
Yeah.
Because you come to kind of one of the motifs of this a few times in the book, which is the exchange of hearts, right? And you begin with a modern example. You know, let me turn to it. You write this. Imagine what a medieval reader would have made of this tale, this modern tale. An 18-year-old boy, a songwriter, is tragically killed in an auto accident. His heart is transplanted into an ailing girl the same age. More than a year later, the boy's parents discover that he had predicted his own death in a song entitled, "Danny, My Heart Is Yours." When the girl sees the boy's picture, she recognizes in him the longtime lover who died to save her life. Quote, "I know he is in me and he is in love with me. He was always my lover, maybe in another time somewhere. How could he know years before he died that he would die and give his heart to me? How would he know my name is Danielle?" Close quote. Okay, wow. So can you please talk about this or explain what's going on here?
Yes. How I came to this, there's a philosopher named Ansel Min at Claremont University in California who invited me about 10 years ago to speak at a conference he had organized on using medieval philosophical thought to shed light on modern problems. And I didn't know him. He invited me out of the blue to speak at this conference. And I said, I can't possibly do that. I'm not even a philosopher. I'm just a literary critic. Yeah. And he said, I know your work. I want you to do this. And so I said, okay. And at that time, I was studying a phenomenon in medieval romance, secular literary form, where two lovers have to part. You know, the lady's husband discovers her lover, or he's going off on crusade, or whatever. They have to part. And so they do a little ritual upon parting where they kiss and exchange their hearts metaphorically. And she says, my heart will go with you. And he says, and my heart will remain with you. And the fiction from then on is that his heart animates her body and her heart gives life to his body. So through this exchange of hearts, they're mystically united in communion, no matter how far apart they become. In some romances, this actually takes a physical, literal form, where, for example, the husband or the lover is killed in battle. He's in the Holy Land. He's in the Crusades. He's killed. And as he's dying, he asks his valet, when I'm gone, have my heart extracted and embalmed and send it in a little casket to my lady. And the valet does this. He has the heart sent to his lady with a letter explaining what happened. The husband intercepts it, and he's very angry because he had known that the lady was having this affair. And he gives the heart secretly to his chef and says, make a delicious meal out of this meat. Mm-hmm. And he serves that to the lady, who says, this is the most delicious thing I have ever eaten. Why have you not served this before? And the husband says, lady, you will never again find that meat at any price, for you have just eaten the heart of him you have loved the most. And then he shows her the letter. And the lady says, in that case, having eaten the best thing I could ever have, I will never eat again. And she starves to death, and she becomes literally the tomb of her lover's heart. The exchange of hearts becomes no longer a metaphor, but an actual corporeal thing. And in thinking about those tales, I thought, wait a minute, we transplant hearts. This is possible now in a literal way that could never have been imagined in the Middle Ages, and yet it was imagined. And so I began reading literature on organ transplants by bioethicists, how they think about this phenomenon, but also a lot of memoirs, anecdotal tales, novels, movies, because it's a thing. It turns out that many heart transplant recipients feel that they have some kind of relationship with the donor. There is a coherence between the living and the dead, and the living person who has received this heart knows things about the donor that they have never been told. They might know their name, facts about them, personality traits change, they become more like the donor. And I thought, okay, I know what I'm going to talk about for this philosophical conference, but I became absolutely fascinated with that exchange.
It is fascinating. What do you do with that? When you read these modern accounts, does the medievalist in you kick in and you say, oh yes, this makes sense? Or does the modern person say, oh, that can't quite be right, this skeptic? How do you kind of balance those two sort of natural kind of reactive tendencies?
I stopped being skeptical. I've actually lectured on this material to a variety of audiences, and in every audience, there is someone who says, I've actually had a heart transplant myself, and I've had that kind of experience.
No kidding.
Not as dramatic as the story of Danielle and the songwriter, but there are many, many, many stories like that. Transplant nurses say, they hear this so often that they just take it for granted now. The people who are skeptical are the surgeons who say, this is magical thinking, this is fantasy, okay. But I think it's a real thing. And I think it also should affect the ethics of organ transplants, because when we agree to be an organ donor, or when we agree to accept to receive a transplant, we need to think that we are entering into that kind of coherence. Lately, there has been an apparently successful transplant of a pig's heart into a man, and I think, what would it mean to have coherence with a pig?
He will never eat bacon again. Let's start there.
Well, that's for sure.
It's fascinating. It really is. And you come back to it in the book a few times, and it's such a compelling phenomenon. Your fourth chapter is on mother and child.
Yes.
As you write at the chapter's outset, I'm quoting you here, no more intimate relationship can be conceived, nor any in which the fates of two persons are so inextricably entwined. In no other situation is one person literally formed by another to so great a degree, close quote. And yet, as you also point out, pregnancy becomes a rich basis for metaphor during the medieval period. Can you tell us about this co-inherence in pregnancy, both literal but also figurative?
Yeah, well, I think any woman who's born a child would understand, you know, once she knew what the concept of co-inherence was, would say, yeah, of course,
right.
Because the fetus is quite literally in the mother's body, but the mother is also in the fetus. She's genetically in the fetus, and her whole heart and mind are bound up with this child, assuming that it's a wanted child that she is bearing. And when the child is born, that relationship continues. I mean, even though the child is no longer in the womb, the child is at the breast, and the mother and the infant are just a dyad. They're deeply bound up together. So I think if you're looking at co-inherence, you can't not look at this relationship, because this is
right.
The most physical,
yep.
Literal form it ever takes. But talking about pregnancy as metaphor, it's remarkable how often pregnancy has been used as a metaphor both for the Trinity and for indwelling of human beings in God. There's an old metaphor, it goes all the way back to Plato, that metaphorically the mind is like a womb, that ideas dwell in the mind as in the womb, and then they are born when we conceive them and utter them and bring them forth. Similarly, the mind of God is the womb of all creation. In Christian Neoplatonism, a tradition I've studied a lot, the whole world and every individual creature in it exists in a kind of virtual form in the mind of God before it comes forth into the world, because God is beyond time. God exists in eternity, and so in God, in the mind of God, all things are simultaneously present, including things that, for us, exist in the future that have not yet come to be. So if we all exist before our earthly span of life as ideas in the mind of God and then come forth, God is eternally pregnant, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another theme that I've worked on a great deal in another book is the idea of God as mother, and God as eternally pregnant is related very much to this idea of the way the fetus exists in the womb.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's a great, really provocative idea that you developed so well in the book. Your last chapter, the fifth of these medieval relationships, is about the example of co-inherence. And it's kind of a harrowing one, right? You have
yes.
gods and benign spirits on the one hand, right? But then you have the devil and demons on the other. And you focus more on the latter than the former in this chapter. What are you trying to get at in this last chapter? And why focus the discussion on what you call diabolophanies, right, or manifestations of the diabolical?
Yeah, because in the Middle Ages, and even more in the early modern period, the time of the witchcraft prosecutions, spirit possession was a common experience. It wasn't rare. Many people had this experience of being possessed by an evil spirit, and everybody believed this was possible. But there came to be increasing suspicion of holy women, of visionaries, of these spiritual mind readers that I talked about earlier. How do you know that that is really God? How do you know that this person is really reading minds in the mind of God and not reading minds through the power of the devil? The same questions were asked about Jesus himself.
Yeah,
I mean,
they
occur in the gospel. And so a new discourse was developed called the discernment of spirits. The discernment of spirits is the branch of theology or better pastoral practice that goes to learning how to tell which is which. Suppose there is a woman, it's almost always a woman, who claims to have visions and revelations and who prophesies the future and who is maybe extremely ascetic, who has intense spiritual practices. How do you know if she's really receiving revelations from God or if she's faking it because she just wants to be honored as a saint and, you know, make a name for herself, or if she's been led astray by the devil, or if she's actually possessed by an evil spirit? Because we know, scripture tells us, right, that the devil disguises himself as an angel of light. So demons love to manifest experiences that look very saintly, but they're not. And so all around these women who might 2 centuries earlier have been admired and venerated as holy people, you get instead this intense scrutiny by their confessors, in particular by clerics, asking, is this real or is this some kind of fraud or diabolical delusion? So that's one example. The other example of the way this plays out is a new and, to my mind, very frightening kind of sanctity, which I call demonic martyrdom, where the holy person is not only practicing charity and intense prayer and having visions and so forth, but is constantly being tortured by demons, is having what I call diabolophanies, where demons visibly appear, they taunt the person, they call them names, they tempt them to suicide, to despair, to blasphemy. They may physically attack the person, you know, buffet them, beat them, do all kinds of horrible things. One example I write about in the book is particularly egregious, where a woman named Christina of Stummeln, who was probably mentally ill, insisted that demons were physically throwing human excrement at her and spattering her garments.
I read this passage to someone, by the way, when I came to the book. I couldn't resist reading it to a friend. I did.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah,
and so because of these two things, this concern with discernment of spirits and telling whether purported holiness was real or fraudulent, and the emergence of these demonic martyrs, I just had to ask, what has coherence gone bad look like?
Right.
And what if the person is not simply interpenetrated benignly by others, but possessed in this truly horrible way?
Yeah, okay. It's fascinating. You know, we have just a few minutes left here to talk. You can, in your book's conclusion, on that point you made about coherence gone bad, in your conclusion, you think a bit about the ethical limits of coherence, right? Our modern idea being that selves should not impinge too far on other selves, that undue influence on one person by another is morally wrong. How do you square that modern sensibility of ours with the idea of coherence? Do our modern ethical mores about, you know, no trespassing on one's selfhood, do they conduce to a healthy spiritual life or a healthy integrated life with other persons? Do you find tensions there in our modern idea of selfhood, given what you know about coherence?
Yeah, I think it's not simply people impinging too much on other selves. I think the issue that's of great concern nowadays, and rightly so, is abuse of power.
Yeah.
When there is a great imbalance of power,
yeah,
which can happen between teacher and student, or between husband and wife, or between priest and penitent, you know, in any kind of intimate relationship where one party has a lot more power than the other, there is danger. And that is why I think professions like psychotherapy, spiritual counseling, teaching, priesthood, all of these intimate practices have developed ethical codes that insist on enforcing boundaries. And I think you need a happy medium because, you know, sexual abuse is one like extreme case, and there Absolutely. Was sexual abuse between medieval teachers and students. I mean, I don't want to disguise that these things could happen. But on the other hand, you don't want to tell a preschool teacher that, you know, if a kindergartner is crying and feeling very sad and has maybe been bullied, the teacher can't hug that child because that would be abuse. I mean, that's carrying it too far. So I think we really need to work hard to come up with common sense boundaries that admit and allow that coherence is a real thing and for the most part a good thing, but one mustn't allow it to be abused by imbalances in power. One always needs to be self-aware about that.
Sure, okay. You know, I have an idea in my head. I guess I'm pregnant with a thought, and it's not fully conceived yet. So I'm just, let me try to kind of to give articulation to it, and you can correct it. We were talking earlier about this perichoresis, this idea in the Trinity, about this dance, you know, of the of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You mentioned that this idea of the dance is so significant because it actually is a more delicate idea about God and the idea of an omnipotent God of power. I do find it to be, in some ways, a sad fact of our modernity that we are so concerned in our modern era, and rightly so, about abuses of power. Mm-hmm. Even when we don't believe in God, we're very concerned about power. We live in a world in that respect that seems much harsher than the kind of world that you're describing in the book, this world of coherence, where there is, at least in the best cases, this delicate interplay of persons with one another, in the best sense, not in the abusive cases. Have you thought about that, about how the world you're describing is in some ways, a gentler world than the one that we currently inhabit?
One can say all kinds of things. I mean, contrasting medieval culture and modern culture. I mean, some would say it's a much more violent culture, it's more Sure. barbaric culture. And in a sense, I'm playing against that. I'm saying, yes, there were barbarities, there was violence. Do we lack violence and barbarity in our own world? Well, hardly. On the other hand, I do believe that we can learn from the past, and not only learn things to avoid, but things to emulate. And this concept of personhood, I think, is one of those things that has a great richness from which we can learn. And maybe this will be a last thought. I want to say that this is not only something we find among medieval European Christians. As I was working on the book, I was quite pleased and enlightened to find a very similar idea coming out of contemporary African philosophy. Mm. And this is the idea of Ubuntu, which can be translated roughly humanity, but it also means humaneness, kindness, and coherence. There's an African proverb, "We are, therefore I am."
That's great.
Which I really love because it's another way of articulating the same idea. And so, you know, I know this philosophy as a medieval thing, but it crops up elsewhere as well, and we can learn from it.
That's great, Ubuntu. That's a great word on which to conclude. It is so great to have you here, Barbara. It's such a pleasure to have you on campus and to be able to talk with you in the podcast. Thank you for your time and expertise.
My pleasure. Again, thanks very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.